Now, today's speaker, I've been looking forward to this talk for a long time, Professor Richard Palmer. He's a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and he's a principal of the Climate Impacts Group. And you can't pick up the paper without reading about climate and its effects on Puget Sound. And the reason that agencies are taking attention to this problem is because of Professor Palmer. He did some of the path-breaking landmark studies on looking at the relationships between climate change and climate variability, its effects on water resources, and he really kept driving home that message to look at the effects, and then agencies really took notice. So we really have him to thank for the work that he's done to kind of turn things around in this region. He's got an incredibly impressive bio. He recently received the Julian Hines Award from the American Society of Civil Engineers, which is the highest award given to service the profession. He also received the Service for the Profession Award in 1998. He was the editor of the Journal of Water Resources Planning and Management, which is the top journal in our field. He was the editor from 1993 to 1997. He received the Hoover Award for Research Excellence by ASCE in 1992. And he has a range of expertise and interests in dealing with water resources systems and optimization and drought management. And we're really fortunate to have him speak this morning. He's got, he's in demand, he's giving a lot of talks, but we're really grateful that he came this morning to speak to us. So with that, let's give a warm introduction. Warm welcome to Professor Paul.
Anne, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to speak in Anne's group. She always has great speakers. And we were talking about either miking up or not miking up. So is it okay in the back? Is this loud enough? No one's saying anything. Up louder? Is there an easy way to get a mic? So maybe we'll mic up just half a second. Sorry. Okay. Is that any better? No.
Oh, it'd be better in a second.
Okay. Okay. We'll keep trying. Is it up yet?
Damn.
It doesn't seem to be on.
One more time.
Okay.
I think you'll just have to yell.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's do this. Let's just provide feedback when you can if I get too quiet. And I apologize, I have a sore throat. I was in New York City over the weekend, and I can't resist. So some of you may be local. There's a great jazz competition that goes on in New York City, and a local high school came in first place, beat every school in the nation, and it was on the Seattle Times front page, over top, above the fold, as they say. So my son made a much higher hit on the newspaper than I ever had. So it's great. I'm going to be, and it was called the Sitting Lake Ellington Contest. It was a great thing. So I'm going to be talking about climate change today. And Anne certainly overspeaks. There's been a lot of people in this region who have been working on climate change, and I'm just one in a group. But I'm going to be talking about regional resources, and that's one of the things that I try to do. So I'm going to talk about climate change specifically, both on water supply, but also try to make the point that water is a very complex and interwoven sort of resource. So I'll talk a little bit about fish, and then I'm going to talk about public involvement in the entire process. So. You know, you can't buy advertising like this. It was wonderful just about a year ago, or a little bit over a year ago, when Time Magazine had this cover that everybody should be worried. And I'm not here to say that everybody should be worried. One of the things that you'll learn when you study climate change is that in countries that have very developed infrastructure, there's often ways to deal with changes in the environment. And climate change is one of those. And it's in the developing countries, I think, that we're going to see a lot of really difficult challenges. But there will be challenges here, and we'll talk about those in just a second. And the other theme that I want to try to make today is the old Yogi Berra saying that the future ain't what it used to be. And what I mean by that is that we have a paradigm in how we look at water resources and how we plan for water resources. And if the future will in fact be different from the past, then that planning paradigm is going to have to shift. So I'm going to talk about this sort of problem in context. I'm going to give a really quick overview, and as Anne introduced me, I'm a civil engineer, and so I'm going to go lightly on the climate science. but I'll just try to state a couple of things that are very well known. I'll kind of focus on the hydrologic aspects of climate change, then talk about regional water supply, and as I said, talk about fish just a little bit, impacts on salmon recovery, and then talk about involving the public. So as a civil engineer, that's a good, interesting spelling of infrastructure. Like I said, I was on the airplane last night, so we'll ignore that for a moment. In this country, there's been billions and billions of dollars spent on providing water. And so there's all this really large investments have been made. In my lifetime and before my lifetime, the focus was definitely on just developing supplies to meet whatever demands were out there. And so the emphasis wasn't on looking at what demands were how they could be changed, but if they're there, let's meet them. And prior to the 1970s, the federal government had a very big role in providing water, and they developed a thing called the Federal Standards and Guidelines, which actually told people how to do water resources planning. And then there was Earth Day, and Earth Day kind of shifted things dramatically. In the water resources, we shifted from building to looking at focusing on operations, managing uncertainty in a way that people could live with. A lot of construction projects were either postponed or they were put on hold. And one of the things that happened is that there was a start of a lot of multidisciplinary collaboration. And the other thing that happened is that the public got involved. I would certainly say prior to the 1970s, there was very little public engagement in the planning of water resources. It was done by planning experts and water resources experts. And we'll talk about how that's changed in just a moment. And there's a new shift that I see, and that is this post-Earth Day shift, where now there's a very clear recognition that climate change is important. And that's going to require us to plan differently, even more so than the sort of post-Earth Day period. And the emphasis is going to be on future scenarios because we don't know what the future is going to hold. We just know that it's not going to be the past repeated. So a couple of quick comments about global climate change. We have on this campus really outstanding people who work in this field. I'm sure Anne either has or will bring them into this lecture series. A few things that we know for sure, that carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases warm the planet, that these greenhouse gases have been increasing at a very rapid rate since 1750. Human activities have increased these concentrations. And what we've seen, what we can measure, what's known, that since 1900, the planet's warmed somewhere between 1 and 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's projected to warm by 2.5 up to 10 by the year 2100. So this is a change in climate that we haven't seen in thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of years. Warming is expected to continue through the 21st century, even if the CO2 emissions were to end today, and that's because of the persistence of CO2 in the atmosphere. But that's not going to happen because China alone has plans for 500 coal-fired plants to go online in the next 10 years, basically a new coal-fired plant every week. So some information now locally. What have we seen in the past since the 1900s? I'm going to show you two graphs that are produced by our state climatologist, Phil Moat, who's done a really outstanding job of putting information together about what's going on in the Pacific Northwest. And I need to emphasize, this is not a graph of Democrats and Republicans and voting patterns or anything like that. This is a really straightforward graph of where it's been warmer and where it's been cooler in what we're going to call the Pacific Northwest, which is, for this moment, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and a little bit of Montana. So the size of the circles are the amount of warming, and the color is whether it's cooler or warmer. And so what you see there is clearly a very strong tendency towards warming. This is based on about 154 stations with long records. I'm not going to show the graph of precipitation that looks very similar, but basically precipitation has been increasing while the climate has been getting warmer since 1920. But when you put rainfall and precipitation together with temperature, one of the things we care about most is what we call snow water equivalent. And that is the amount of water that's held in the snow. So if you take a column of snow and melt it, the amount of water that's left is a snow water equivalent. And this is a picture that looks at the data since 1950 And again, blues, in this case, would be increases, and reds are decreases. And over much of the state of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and that edge of Montana, what you see are significant decreases in the snow water equivalent. And this is measured on April 1st. So what it means is that at the end of the snow season, right as the spring begins and water starts coming off these mountains, there has been less and less water. So I don't know, how many of you are aware of the debate about what's happened in snow water equivalent that was in the newspaper recently? I don't know, maybe not. So not many, so let's not mention it. We'll leave it where it's at. But basically, there's been somewhere between a 30 and a 60% decline in the snow water equivalent out there since 1950. We have been blessed in the Pacific Northwest by having this natural reservoir in the mountains that collects snow. And if it changes, that's going to have large impacts. Here's an example real close to us. This is at Mount Gardner. And what I want to say about this picture is what we see here is that there's a large variability year to year about the amount of snow that's there on April 1st. And so the solid lines here are actually observed in the dots are observed, and the solid line is a simulated amount of snow from some of our models. And what you can see, the models capture this pretty well, and there's a general downward trend. And I just want to show one more picture. That line is put there not to let your eyes deceive you. Actually, the decrease has been about 50% there. That's a straight line, the blue. But if we continue, this is a whole lot of different stations. This is five stations in about the same area. And if you look at the trend in all of them, there's high variability, but the general trend is downward, about 4 inches per decade. So if you're a skier and you're looking at 4 inches per decade, pretty soon you're going to start having some challenges in skiing in the Pacific Northwest at low elevations in the future. Okay, so as the snow water equivalent changes, and as it gets warmer, what we're also going to see is changes in runoff. And so these dots also show there's a high variability, but on the left-hand side, what we have is the percent of the annual runoff from a particular stream, and this is a stream that feeds the Seattle water supply system. So on the left-hand side, it's the percent of the runoff that occurs in March, and on the right-hand side is the percent of the runoff that occurs in June. And what's happening is the runoff in March is increasing by about 10% from the past, and the runoff in June is decreased by, well, it's 8%, but I could round up to 10%. And so what's happening is that snow is coming off earlier in the year, but so flows are higher in the spring in these streams and lower in the summer. And, of course, it's in the summer where we have high water demands when we'd like to have water available. Okay, so where are we headed? These are all things from the past. This is looking backwards. If we look at where we're headed, the projections are something like this. I'll talk about general circulation models in just a moment, but there's among those general circulation models, there's general agreement that there's going to be an increase in temperature in the future. So forecasted for the Pacific Northwest is by 2020 an increase of 2.5 degrees over the 1990 sort of period, and an increase of almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit by 2040 compared to the 1990s. So I'll admit, I was raised in Dallas, Texas, and the summers here are not warm enough for me, personally. However, we have an ecosystem that's based on that, and so what we're going to see is some real general warming. Precipitation looks like it's up about 7% during both those periods, and if you follow these discussions, you'll know that we feel much more comfortable with our forecast of temperature than we do of precipitation. So the bottom line in general, particularly for our streams and their impacts on streams, are warmer, wetter winters and, unfortunately, warmer summers with lower stream flows. So what might that mean to us? I'm going to show you this one picture, and I know most of – well, I'm the vast majority of you aren't hydrologists, but I just want to show you a general idea of what happens. That black line graph there represents sort of the typical runoff in a Pacific Northwest stream at a low elevation. So what you see, and this is on a water year, so the left-hand side is October 1st. Hydrologists count their years starting October 1st. What you see is the stream flow is ramping upward and then actually coming down during December and January and portions of February, and then coming back up during March. And that isn't because it doesn't rain much, as you know. having lived through a winter here. It isn't raining in November and December. It's just that the rain falls as snow, and so it doesn't reach the streams, and so the stream flows decrease. And then around March and April, what you see is that melting process, and that black line goes scurrying upward, and then it falls back down in a normal recession. And that recession is a result of the fact that the snow has disappeared and it's actually quit raining. We were having a nice dry summer. So what you see, if we focus on that red line, is much higher flows in the winter. And that's because it'll be warmer and some of that precipitation that would have fallen as snow is now falling as rain. And then in the springtime, what you see is the red line doesn't go up nearly as far as the black line. And that's because there isn't as much snow there to melt in the spring. And then that red line drops off much more rapidly than the black line and goes to a lower values, meaning the stream flows will be quite low. And that's a real challenge for the environment, the ecosystem, and fish habitat. So I want to say a couple of things about how we evaluate the impacts of climate change. This is cartoonish. I've taken out some of the items, but basically what we do is take the outputs from general circulation models, which is I have shown here as a black box, which is pretty much what it is. We don't run these models, they're not available for us to run, but what we can do is take information from those models that forecast the change in climate in the future. Then we have to go through a process that we call downscaling, which is what that second figure represents, and that's converting these large global signals to local signals. And that's an important process that we go through and something of interest in terms of research. On the right-hand side of this figure is multi-layer, and it represents a hydrology model. And so now all of our models are what we call distributed. And so they're GIS-driven with maps of soils, elevation, vegetation, and things like that. From that hydrology model represented on the right-hand side, we get runoff, and then the big yellow figure there in the center represents some sort of systems analysis model where we take that information and determine how it's going to impact water supply, and then we get a result, and I'll talk about these in just a little bit. So what I described there is written down here, so I won't go through this. Frederick and Peter Glick were probably the first to sort of formalize this process of evaluating the impacts of climate change on water resources. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about one particular area, and then we'll kind of generalize it. All of you who are in this building are probably drinking Cedar River water. Your water comes from the Cedar River. The colors there are pretty subtle, but the Cedar Basin is outlined in green, and you can see a map of the region there on the upper right-hand side. All the water that is provided by Seattle comes from three major sources, mostly the Cedar. We're closest to it, and so that's the water we typically drink. Some from the South Fork Tolt, which is a little further north. There are two major reservoirs in the system. Those reservoirs, in addition to the snowpack, are used to sort of hold water in storage during the winter. The combined storage is only about 68% of average annual demand. And so what that means to us is that these reservoirs fill every year. This isn't like a Colorado system where it might take 5 or 6 years to run off during low periods to refill. We tend to refill every year. And because of that, storage in the snowpack is important during the late summer months. If it's going to be a dry summer and you don't have a lot of rainfall to help you during this period, snowpack is extremely important. And then there's a question of what kind of river basins are impacted the most. And so if you're up in a really high elevation and the temperature changes just slightly, then that snowpack isn't going to be affected very much. If your average temperature is minus 20 and it goes up by 1 degree, precipitation falling will stay as snow. But a lot of our systems, water that's provided for the city of Seattle, Tacoma, Everett, is what we call transitional watersheds, are much lower. And so a small change in temperature can convert what would have been snow into rain, and therefore it runs off earlier. So the systems that rely most on snowpack will be the most impacted. And the other thing that happens, you'll see in the figure in just a moment, is that unusual events are going to become more common. So three graphs in a row here, and then we'll get away from graphs for a while. So this figure represents the forecast of annual snowpack between current conditions represented by the year 2000 and then 2020 and 2040. And this is meant to represent the snowpack for the city of Seattle. And what we're forecasting is that by the year 2040, about half of the snowpack will be lost due to the change in temperature. And so what you see is snowpack reaching its peak in late March or early April in these figures. And as we go from the year historic to 2000 to 2020 and 2040, what you see is that maximum snowpack going down. Then another thing that happens is that the runoff time period is shifted. It's going to be shifted earlier in time. There's been a lot of really good studies on the timing of runoff, and much of the West Coast estimate is that peak runoff is now occurring somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks earlier than it has in the past, and that shift is going to continue as we go forward into the future. And then finally, this last figure. So this is a cumulative distribution function, so it represents the probability of a flow being greater than or equal to a specific value. And if we just go in and look at the middle point, which would be the 50% probability level, and I apologize, the 0.5 isn't there, but look between the 0.4 and the 0.6, what you're seeing is actually that the amount of quantity of water stored in the snowpack is going to be about half in the future of what it was in the year 2000. And the extremes are also much less than what they were. So we'll have less maximum snowpack and a good deal less snowpack, more than, let me say this, the percent reduction is even more than 50% during the really low snowpack years. So extreme events will become much more common. So you take all the information and you put it into a model, and then you try to evaluate what's going to happen to our ability to meet water supply needs. And so this is a figure which is an attempt to represent what we call the yield of a water supply system. And so the city of Seattle, or the city of Portland, who we've worked with, or the city of Everett, who we've worked with, or the city of Tacoma, who we've worked with, you build these models and you try to express how much their yield might change in the future. And what I want to try to get from this, and it's a little bit complicated, this is a run of four different climate models. And what it suggests overall is that the water supply system will decrease by about 20 million gallons per day by the year 2040. So they will have less water available to them in the future. And that's from all the things we just saw, that it comes off earlier and that under low flow conditions there will be even less flow. Now, I've really gotten in a lot of trouble with the city of Seattle for showing this picture. And there's a good reason for that, which is that people are bright and they can change their operations. And so this figure represents a system that isn't changing over time, which is to say the operators aren't using better monitoring their snowpack. I see Jessica's here, and so she could tell us all about how to better monitor snow and know how much actual water is in the snowpack. But if we were to continue to manage the system as we had in the past, we would see fairly substantial losses. Well, what does 20 MGD mean? Does it mean anything? Well, we'll talk about that. So each system we've studied, every system I've studied in the Pacific Northwest has lost yield. So that means that in the future they should be able to supply less water than they have in the past. On the other hand, the region's infrastructure is extremely complicated and it's interwoven, and I'll show you a picture of that in just a second. But the bottom line is there's less water that will be available to us during those periods where demand is greatest. And when I say it's interwoven, here's just a quick picture, and that didn't come out so very well. But if you look at the top, there's Everett. It has the Salton River system. There's Seattle with its two reservoirs there that are the Tolt and the Cedar. And then at the bottom, what we see is the Tacoma system. And now the Tacoma system is being intertied with the water supply that's on the east side, on the east side of Lake Washington. Water which used to be demanded from the city of Seattle in the future is going to not be demanded by Seattle, because Bellevue and many of the suburbs have signed a contract saying we don't want to take Seattle's water in the future. We want to develop our own water supply. So all of this is quite complicated. But the fact is, in the next 20 years, population is supposed to grow somewhere between 400 and 600,000 in this region, and so there's going to be a lot more demand for water. Okay, so we always think about possible solutions to these problems. One of the things they can do is operate the system differently. They can have better monitoring in the watershed. You can use voluntary mandatory restrictions. If you haven't lived in the region for a long time, in 1987 and in 1992, we had mandatory water use restrictions where we couldn't water lawns outdoors. To my knowledge, no one died from not being able to water their lawn. Although it had economic impacts, there were active timber, pulp and paper industry companies were negatively impacted by such things because they did not water outside. They actually had to have less water for their production. But regional interties, as I was suggesting, is a great way to look at how to tie the system together, so maybe not everyone is only has access to their own individual system. There's been a really great success story in terms of water conservation here. Right now, the city of Seattle and its suburbs demand less water than they did in 1976. So there's been 30 years of growth, and water demands are lower than that. And so that's a tremendous success story. Water reclamation, King County, as many of you know, is looking at water reclamation as a potential problem-solving solution here. And then water pricing. So I can't resist. How many of you know how much you pay for your water? So would you guess that it might be priced too low if you don't even bother to know what it costs? What do you think? So for those of you who raised your hands, how much does water cost? What does the city of Seattle charge for water? So this is always interesting. So sometimes I talk to grade schools and I ask them that question, and I'm not surprised they don't know the answer to that question. But this is a room full of people interested in the environment, interested in managing resources, interested in the future, right? So knowing what you pay for water and where that money goes would be, that's a useful thing. So you might think about that. And you could answer me, if I told you you pay $1 per 100 cubic feet, or $2 per 100 cubic feet, or $10 per 100 cubic feet, you might not know the answer to that. So look it up. It would be useful for you. Because this is one of the ways that resources don't get used wisely, is when we don't know what they cost us. So, okay, water pricing. So we could double your prices and you guys wouldn't care, apparently. That would be my guess. We don't know. Okay, I want to say I have about 4 slides on salmon and 4 slides on another issue. We did a study with NOAA, James Batten and Mary Zwickel's house, we were really lucky. It just came out in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. And the goal of that study was to look at the potential impacts of climate change on Chinook in the Snohomish River Basin. So the Snohomish is just north of us and an important basin. And for that study, we didn't do tons and tons of models. We looked at 2 climate change models and looked at the year 2000, 2025, and 2050. But then the important thing was there was a salmon recovery plan in place. And what we were trying to look at is if they changed land use, which was a really important part of their plan, would that be able to help the recovery, and would it overshadow the impacts of climate change? And so this is kind of a rough story, right? Because people get together, they do planning, they get a plan on how to deal with salmon recovery, and then someone like us from the outside comes along and says, but did you think about climate change? And they say no, and then we say, well, let's see what happens with climate change. So a great answer would be, it doesn't matter. Just continue with your plan and you'll get there. That would be a great answer. So let's see if that's the answer. Okay, so the way we did this graphically, we took, again, these changes in CO2 in the atmosphere. We used 2 models, the GFDL model and the Hadley model. We used that. And on the left-hand side, that land cover and landform data, that's where we did the change in land use that was part of the habitat plan. Then we ran that through our hydrology model. We had a model called Shiraz, which is a fish production model. In this model, it didn't look at activities in the ocean. It only looked at the activities in the life cycle within the streams. And then we forecasted salmon abundance. And I'm going to show you this final picture, and then I'm going to talk about what we did. But this is a very sobering picture. If you look across the top 2 panels on the right-hand side, Those are changes that we're predicting in terms of decreases in the number of returning spawners. And if you look at a particular model, a GFDL model, and so across the top there, what we see is a decrease in about 40 and 25% of the returning salmon. About 38% if you just continue without any changes in land use, and 23% if you go to this restoration land use pattern. So unfortunately, that climate change model suggests that even if you try to restoring salmon by changing land use, 50 years from now, you're still losing 25% of the current quantity of salmon that you have, and that's totally due to climate change. And then in the bottom, this other model is actually a drier model than the top model, and we'll talk about that in the next slides. And they forecast if you continue with business as usual, you lose 14% of the returning salmon, and if you go to the restoration land use policies, you only lose about 5%. So that's better news. Unfortunately, the two models have slightly different results. And let me just summarize with a slide rather than pictures of where this is coming from. What we found was the most important feature on in this modeling of the salmon returns was the impact on peak flows. So for these models with warmer temperatures, peak winter flows are going up dramatically. And that change in peak flows is what really hammered the salmon in terms of their life cycle. Okay. The impacts on low flow were significant, but less than those from the peak flows. And then the impacts on temperatures were also important. And we're forecasting basically whatever the change in air temperature is what they're going to see in the stream, somewhere between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees centigrade. Okay, so that's not good news in terms of the salmon story. So let me just say a couple things about engaging the public. And the reason this is a good transition is because that salmon recovery plan did engage the public, and they were very active in getting people involved. So I'll make a couple of claims here. That decision at the local level are driven by a number of groups, and they're driven by resource agencies, utilities, the people who make use of water in the region, and engaged stakeholders. I'll make this point. 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. You could have stopped this sentence with resource agencies and utilities, but now definitely engaged stakeholders are very important. If we're going to start including climate change in these studies, it's going to require us to look at this from a different point of view. And first of all, just acknowledging the fact that there's climate change. And there's a real need to educate the public and the profession in the need for including climate change in planning. Okay, so there's an activity going on right now that's being sponsored by King County and a number of different agencies. And let me just take a look at, okay, so I didn't list all the agencies in the next slide. But it involves King County, Pierce County, Snohomish County, Department of Ecology, the City of Seattle. There's about 32 different agencies involved in this regional planning process. So all these many agencies and organizations came together voluntarily to try to identify, compile information, and discuss sort of the key focuses that are going to be in this region of how we will use water in the future and how that's going to affect the region. And so those of you who have been involved in this sort of open public planning process knows that that's really challenging, that it's very easy for individuals or agencies to take specific points of view and not be flexible. And I've had a chance to work in a lot of places and see that happen, but I feel really positive about what's going on in this region. All those groups are working really hard on trying to generate good information, then use that in decision making. And the bottom bullet down here is the real challenge, is that because it's voluntary, all the participants are free to either accept or reject the results of the process. So there's no binding planning process that's going on right now. So one of the things we tried to do, and sort of what Ann alluded to early on, was that I tried to step in and say that we really need to make this process embrace climate change. Otherwise, when we're done, and these are long plans, these are plans for 20 to 40 years. Otherwise, when we're done, we may make a plan that works great for today, but may not work so good for the future. So the first thing we did was make a committee that was going to look at climate change. What we did was create a document that used only peer-reviewed literature. And that's a really interesting process and a public process where people bring in things they want you to read and believe are true about climate change, and they don't always come from reputable sources. You know, I heard on Rush Limbaugh today that, and then you go from there. So we said, no, it had to appear, had to have appeared in the peer-reviewed literature. And one of the real challenges in this is that there's a lot of uncertainty, of course. This is an emerging science. And some people in our group really didn't want to move forward because until all the uncertainties were gone. But that never happens, and so we weren't able to do that. So what we created was a building, what we called a building blocks climate change document, where we listed 15 items that we thought everyone would agree to that were associated with climate change. I thought it'd be really easy. I thought we could do it in two meetings. There were about 17 people on the committee. It took us 6 months, not two meetings, to pound our way through this. But in the end, we had a document that everyone in this planning process would agree to. Okay, so I'm not going to harp on that too much. I'll go ahead. Some final comments. Regional water supply. So the forecast for the region is that climate change will really have a significant impact on water supply, and particularly stream flows by the year 2040. There are four or five major reservoirs in the region that by operating them in specific ways, you may be able to mitigate the impacts of climate change. But most of the region doesn't have reservoirs. It's not controlled. And their stream flow characteristics are going to change. These changes are going to put further pressures on already strained systems. We have listed species in all over this region. There is no aspect of climate change that I see is going to help endangered species. Decreases in water demand luckily have limited the need for new sources in the region, and we hope that people will continue to act responsibly and keep that under control. And really, regional cooperation, from my point of view, offers the most viable option in terms of alternatives, being able to intertie between these systems. In terms of salmon recovery, it really may not be possible to fully mitigate the dual impacts of changes in land use and changes in climate. That's just, it's going to be, it's a really difficult thing to deal with. As I said before, the most significant impacts that we are not going to be able to control is peak flows and increase in temperatures. Those are really going to be hard to manage. But it points to a really clear need to continue in these areas if we want to maintain these endangered species. And in terms of public engagement, there's a real opportunity, I think, right now, this window of opportunity to actually change the planning paradigm that we use to make people think about climate change. But to do that, we've got to go back to all those steps I showed you before. Get the climate models, downscale them, get new stream flows to look at, and that is a challenge. But to change it, people have to be involved because they're the ones who are going to really make some final decisions. And I've really been involved with a lot of stakeholders, and I wanted to show you the best picture I have of an active stakeholder there. Very engaged, active stakeholder. Okay, I'm going to close here. I tried to leave a little bit of time for questions, so we'll be happy to take any questions you have. Great, thank you. It's a quiet group. Yes?
I was looking at that figure you showed of the Snohomish Basin with changes in abundance of salmon projected climate change.
Right.
And I'm wondering why, a couple things maybe. First, you had that business as usual model.
Right.
And both business as usual models look like in some places with business as usual, abundance of salmon actually increased. And I'm wondering if that's because of, or if you have the idea of that.
Yeah, just have a second. Here we go. Let me pull that back up. I often have a slide in here that's just of the basin itself. And so let me say a couple of things about the slides. So you see some areas that are all gray there. And most of those areas in these regions that are all gray, there are actually either natural or artificial barriers to salmon in those areas. So first explanation, not addressing your question, is that there are some areas in which there just are no salmon due to either man-made barriers or natural barriers. So that's all the gray part. And so if we get any kind of blue areas, and they would be down here on the Hadley model. So The Hadley model is a really, in terms of climate change, we took kind of two extreme streams. The GFDL model is a wet model, and the Hadley model is a drier model. So in the Hadley model, some of those increases in blue colors are due to the fact that the winter flows are actually slightly less than the historic winter flows. And so these big rushes of floods that wipe out the salmon reds and make it really difficult to maintain next year production, that would be why there's a blue in those areas. But it's almost never due to warmer temperatures being good for the fish or things like that.
Last question is why the upper watershed looks like it's going to be sort of the most severely impacted in both models. Is that because sort of the nature of the watershed?
It is the nature of the watershed. So at the higher elevations, this is really, I believe that whole ridge that we're seeing in red is some of the higher elevation parts of it, and so that's the ones that are seeing sort of the story we told before. It's sort of right that transition. In the bottom of these basins, where we have a lot of kind of washed out tan colors on some of these, and the ones close to zero, they're low enough that the temperature changes aren't, at least the temperature changes aren't going to impact the hydrology. Yeah, those are great questions. Yes, sir.
The impacts of climate change on glaciers.
Uh-huh.
Is the reduction due to higher precipitation and rain as opposed to snow?
Yeah, that's
because the temperature is relatively warmer or combination thereof.
Right. There's a great paper that Dennis Luttenmeier and it was in Nature 2 years ago. I think Barnett was the first author, and Luttenmeier is one of the authors. So the glacier story is a really interesting story. And so if you're at a really, really high elevation and there's climate change and it rains more, it's possible that glaciers may accumulate at those really high elevations. That would be great. Unfortunately, what we've seen all across the country, world, and what this paper really does a great job of documenting is the fact that glaciers are decreasing all across the world in general. And the really bad news is that they're decreasing in areas of very high population. And so in India and China, where people rely on late summer flows from glacier melt, so they catch it in the winter and it goes away during the summer. As those glaciers continue to recede and they melt, that water is going to actually disappear in the future. And the really ironic thing is that maybe over the next 20 years, stream flows will be higher in the summer at these locations as the glaciers disappear. And people are people, and so, look, higher flows, let's develop more around these. And then they're going to reach the point where that decline in the glacier is going to be abrupt and basically be no longer available, and then flows will really decrease in the summertime. So you might want to look at that Nature paper, and that basically it says globally glaciers are disappearing dramatically at a faster rate than predicted. Yeah. In the back, yeah.
Is the GFDL model?
Yeah. So Phil, our state climatologist, Phil Moat, has a really nice paper in which he looks at a large number of models. And so some models are warmer and cooler, warmer and wetter in summer, cooler and drier, and there's all these combinations. And so he's sort of laid these out very, very nicely. And so what we've tried to do is pick some that represent interesting combinations of those, and we don't really have a way to suggest that one is really more likely than the other. So I used the term scenario in this talk a long time ago and didn't emphasize it. So since we don't know which is likely to occur among those models, we think about running different scenarios from these models. And a funny thing is that even though a model fits in a certain category, once you get it through the process and into a hydrology model, you may get a result that you didn't anticipate just because it's slightly warmer but wetter than another one. So this is one of the real challenges in communicating things to people, is that these models are slightly different and they may give you different results. And when people start to feel uncertain about that, what I try to say is, well, let's stop and let's look at the last 50 years. And when in this region, when you see snowpack decreasing, you see summer flows decreasing, there's really nothing that we see that would really shift that dramatically in a different direction. So even though these models have slightly different shapes to them, almost all of them suggest warmer. And the wetter is kind of, wetter or drier is the challenge. And the idea is that a warmer globe is going to have more precipitation in general. And the hard part we have is knowing where that precipitation is going to land and what part of the year is going to land. One thing we've really noticed is November storm events here in the Pacific Northwest have increased dramatically, the intensity of storms. And only for November and December, not any other part of the year. And so these sort of really difficult things to estimate are going to take several more generations of researchers to figure them out. Yeah. Yes?
Just follow up on that, right? Have you seen anything about rain on snow and that changes?
That's a really great question. And so for flooding in the Pacific Northwest, November is a really key month, and it occurs when there is some snowpack, and maybe it's even a little bit ripe, and a Pineapple Express comes through, warm rain on snow creating this event. And I don't think we have the climate models yet in place that can really simulate that to the extent that we want. Yeah.
I think we're out of time. Let's thank Professor Palmer.